You know, we hear so much about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Often we don't really know the history on the ground. You will today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So I woke up this morning with some interesting news. My flight to Virginia Beach tonight was canceled because of the storm, the blizzard on the East Coast. I was supposed to be on 700 Club tomorrow morning talking about my book, Saving a Sick America. And then Saturday scheduled to fly into New York City, where I'll be doing some intensive Jewish apologetics teaching, some advanced Jewish apologetics teaching. Of course, blizzard in the New York area as well. The governor of North Carolina, where I live, has called for a state of emergency because of the snow, which means we may get a few inches, maybe a foot. But down the south, they don't quite deal with snow, not prepared, equipped for it the way they are up north. So here I am, glad to be with you. I would have been here anyway, but glad to not have to fly out tonight, although I was looking forward to 700 Club. That means what? Well, life goes on as usual. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. That is the number to call with any Jewish-related question. It can be a question about the Hebrew language. It can be a question about Israel today. It can be a question about Judaism, Jewish tradition, Jewish objections to Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. I was absolutely delighted to get a call yesterday from a young man, describes himself as modern Orthodox. Ben Shapiro would be described as modern Orthodox, so a religious Jew, but not ultra-traditional. And my take was a gentleman that called yesterday is a bit more religious than say, a Ben Shapiro would be as modern Orthodox. But he's 20 years old. For the last 5 years, has really been seeking truth. Maybe you're listening again, sir. I hope so. Seeking the truth about God, about the Messiah, and watching our debates, and is pretty well convinced, really feels that Jesus, Yeshua, is the Messiah, and just kind of wanted to understand, what do you do about congregational life, and were you a member in a church, in a Messianic congregation? How does it work? So we are thrilled for every Jewish person listening who does not yet believe that Jesus Yeshua is the Messiah, or a Jewish person listening, watching, who is struggling with these issues, we'd love to help you. And if you're in a situation, you may be a very traditional Jew, and you cannot give out your identity, you cannot say where you're calling from. If we wanted to send you materials, we can't, because you can't be found out. Call completely anonymously. Just say you're an anonymous caller from nowhere, and we'll gladly take your call. 866-348-7884. All right. So there is a lot of fresh talk now about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And President Trump not only officially recognizing Jerusalem, gets the expected pushback from Palestinian leadership, although there's been a lot less in terms of protest and violence than I would have expected could have come. But now President Trump has told Mahmoud Abbas, Palestinian Authority, if you don't get serious about peace talks with Israel, we're going to cut off our aid. Why are we giving you hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars every year? You're not serious about peace talks. And Abbas is basically responding with, you can't buy us with your money. Things continue to heat up. What I want to do is try to give you a context background so that you'll have a little bit better understanding of why many Israelis feel the way they do and why many evangelical Christians stand with Israel and why Palestinians feel the way they do and look at Israel as an occupier or even an evil occupier. I want to be as fair as I can, but you understand my own view that it is God himself who brought our people back to the land and reestablished us in the land, and therefore to oppose that is to oppose God's will. You know my view on that. Before I get into some of the history, though, the man who befriended me when I was brand new believer, my dad said, look, we're Jews. We don't believe in this. Will you talk to the rabbi? So I went and met with the local rabbi. I was 16. He was 26 or 27 at that time. Brilliant young man. I was just a teenager, of course. He was fresh out of Jewish Theological Seminary. Probably could have gone on for an academic career. Many rabbis are very well educated. And, you know, there's an old joke that when Christians have trouble, they pray. When Jews have trouble, they study. You know, talking about religious Jews and religious Christians, that there's spiritual study a Jew will do studying religious tradition, and Christians are more apt to pray. But he befriended me. He's the one that challenged me to learn Hebrew. He spent many hours with me, studying with me, taking me to meet other rabbis. He was really instrumental in challenging me and became a real dear friend. I spent time with Nancy when I met Nancy, and we invited him to our wedding, and he said he'd love to go, but he can't because it's a Christian wedding. And of course, we understood that and respected that. But just a few minutes ago, I don't know why I didn't look for him on Facebook all these years. It's been some years since we've been in touch. Maybe last time was, 10, 12 years ago, and very gracious and warm. I sent him my Jeremiah commentary when it came out subsequently. But didn't even think of looking for him on Facebook, but there he was. And I just spotted right before the show. So if you're watching, I can't pull this up now. I don't think I can. It's a little late. But let me read to you what he posted. This is a Jewish man, conservative Jew. So conservative does not mean politically. Conservative is a branch of Judaism, and it is more liberal than it is conservative in terms of politics and things like that. Rabbi, I'm not going to mention his name, he posted this. A colleague of mine cogently remarked that a spiritual heritage is different from the realities of a modern political state. In other words, Jerusalem being the capital of Israel is a spiritual thing, not a political thing. So what Donald Trump did is of no significance to us. We know what our spiritual capital is. We have other political issues to tackle. This is a perspective of a highly educated rabbi. There is no doubt, he says, that for three millennia, Jerusalem has played a major role in the spiritual psyche of the Jewish people. However, those who automatically sanctify a modern state and insist that it is a harbinger of the Messianic era, no matter the realities on the ground, are falling into the trap of Cookism. Cookism refers to the teachings of Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the son of the first chief rabbi of pre-state Palestine in modern times, Abraham Cook. Throughout the history of the Jewish people, this rabbi writes, well, I didn't tell you his name, it's Public Post, Rabbi William Berman. Throughout the history of the Jewish people, redemption was associated with Teshuvah, referring to the moral, ethical, and religious self-purification of the people of Israel worldwide. Never until Cook was an entity that has the same flaws and strengths as other countries automatically deemed sacred. To do so is to use religious justification for modern nationalism, something which many pious Jews in the yeshiva and Hasidic world considered an anathema, and rightly so. In other words, to say, okay, modern Israel has been restored, and that means that God is restoring it. There are many religious Jews who said, no, Israel is to be a spiritual state. Modern Israel is secular. Israel is to be founded by God. This is being founded by atheistic Jews and communist Jews and non-believing Jews. So how could this be God? And what's the purpose of a modern state of Israel if it is not Torah observant, the Sabbath observant, etc.? It's just secular. Who needs it, right? It would be like saying, you know, America is a Christian nation, and then America becomes the greatest power in the whole world, and it's totally secular, worldly. We say, you see, it's a Christian nation. We say, no, it's not a Christian nation. How's that work? So, again, let's look back at what this rabbi is saying. And his point is that many traditional Jews in the ultra-traditional world hotly opposed the modern state of Israel. All right? So he says this, Jerusalem may be our spiritual capital, and for Israelis, the political capital, but it is populated with real human beings who desperately need peace and tranquility to pursue their lives in a productive way. A few days ago, President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This amounts to nothing. Its only result has been and will be to retard any peace process and cause bloodshed. Israel does not need anyone to tell her which city is her capital. Moreover, whether people like it or not, one-third of the population of Jerusalem is Arab. Jerusalem Arabs live in a limbo state, neither citizens nor non-citizens of Israel. Periodically, there is violence, especially on the Temple Mount, on top of which lies the Al-Aqsa Mosque. One may continue to repeat the refrain of Jerusalem, the eternal capital of the Jewish people. But I find this declaration vapid. Again, this is a rabbi writing. First of all, what is meant by Jerusalem? After the Six-Day War, Israel quadrupled the initial municipal boundaries of the city, incorporating Arab villages whose populations have since mushroomed. The parts of Jerusalem in which Jews live now, including vast areas over the Green Line that will surely remain part of Israel in any settlement, is far larger than biblical or post-biblical Jerusalem. But it is not only vapid, but also ironic and amusing how many American Jews vociferously repeat the above refrain while they choose to live here in the comfort of America, while Israelis pay the price in blood for keeping Jerusalem united. Moreover, in case you haven't noticed, it is not united. That is a fantasy. How many would like to take a leisurely stroll through the vast neighborhoods of Arab Jerusalem? It is one of the least united cities in the world. Only a sober approach can lead to peaceful resolution so that Jerusalem can be a city of the spirit and peace in reality and not just in people's imagination. Well, of course, as I would expect from my old rabbi friend, he has some important insights and raises important questions. And although he doesn't mention evangelical Christians, and I'm sure he appreciates the friendship of evangelical Christians, he could easily say, look, you're just naive and you're making this into a prophetic event and so on and so forth. Why then do we feel this is important? He raises valid questions. I believe it is important, number one, because it is recognizing reality. This is the reality on the ground. Jerusalem is the functioning capital of Israel. And therefore, to recognize it, it's like to recognize I have a mustache or a nose on my face. It is simply fact. Might as well deal with the facts before we try to work out some type of peace deal based on fantasy. That's one thing. Another thing is this. I do believe scripturally that Jesus will return to a Jewish Jerusalem. Therefore, I see this as important as well. And by President Trump doing it, I believe he is standing for righteousness and doing what is honorable in the eyes of the Lord and standing with Israel and basically telling the Palestinians, look, if you want peace, you're just going to have to accept this and we'll work with you in your best interests, but you're just going to have to let this go, at least let it go the way you want to hold on to it. So yes, there are many issues to raise. And as we get into some of the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the broadcast today, I do want to be fair. And I do want to say, look, here's why Palestinians have an issue and this is how they look at things. But that does not diminish my belief that God has restored the Jewish people to the land, that the modern state of Israel is a miracle, and that it is good that our president recognized Jerusalem. We'll come back, take some of your Jewish-related calls, and then I'll give you a bit more history about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be here with you. I hope you are enjoying our new clock. Just a reminder, we start every show 3 minutes into the hour, and then 3 minutes at the bottom of the hour, 3 minutes in. So 03 and 33 on your clock. Then we only have one break in each segment. So longer segments, less breaks, more radio and video time with you. Everyone listening on the radio, listening on your computer, watching on Facebook, watching on YouTube. Hey, great to be on the air with you today. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to the phones. We'll start in Mesa, Arizona. James, I guess in Mesa it's not exactly snowing, huh?
No, bright and sunny over here.
All right.
Thanks for having my call. My question was kind of a two-fold question.
Yeah.
Regarding the Hebrew language. So I
yes,
recently
sir.
Came up on, been learning how to read Biblical Hebrew and Aramaic, and I'm still learning, you know, and my goal is to be able to read it without the vowel pointing. So my question is, and the way I'm learning, it seems like it's almost impossible to read it without the vowel pointing, because like certain stems, like, you know, like call imperfect or the niphal imperfect, they look exactly alike. So I was wondering, like, how is it possible to read it? Do you have to, like, read the whole entire chapter to get the context of a single verse?
No,
it's two things.
Yeah, it's two things. First, when you read the Quran, when you read the Hebrew Bible, you read them both with vowels, the Arabic with vowels, the Hebrew with vowels. But if you read a modern book in Arabic or just some other classical book in Arabic, or if you read some other book in Hebrew, a newspaper, an older book, they're all written without vowels. And
yeah.
You get used to reading without vowels, and you do understand. Every so often, it depends on how fluent you are. And sometimes you spend hours trying to figure something out, and you realize, oh, that was somebody's name. I remember reading an Arabic newspaper years ago, and I was totally stuck and couldn't figure it out. It was something about President Jimmy Carter, and I was going over and over and over it. It was the name Cyrus Vance put in Arabic. And my Arabic teacher in college said that they were at some summer camp studying Arabic, and they were not allowed to ask their teachers questions at night, but they were working on something all night, and they couldn't figure it out. They finally got to the teacher and said, what does this mean? We can't figure out the Arabic. And it was Mao Zedong in Arabic. So, you know, sometimes you just miss things. But basically, with biblical Hebrew, it's simple. First, you get used to reading it with vowels because the vowels are there. But if you were reading from a Torah scroll, you're reading, say, scrolls from Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that, they don't have vowels. So it's just a matter of getting more and more familiar with the text. Initially, you'll never be able to do it. It takes years and years and years of really learning Hebrew well. And then still there'd be some ambiguity here and there without the vowels. And you realize it could go one way or the other. But I would make that a secondary goal. I would work on fluency, reading it, learning it. And then after a time, you look at a manuscript without vowels, and you'll be surprised how much you do get and how much you're still missing.
Okay, and then just real quick on this, my second question was on, so with that learning, you know, the Aramaic and biblical Hebrew, so I came across, you know, Psalm 212 and how it always translates as kiss the sun. And when I look at the Nashkuvar, you know, I understand that, you know, the bar is supposed to be the Aramaic word for sun, but it's missing the definite article that's translated as the sun. So I was wondering how can that translation be possible to say kiss the sun?
All right, now here, James, I'm sitting here with a big smile because it's a great question, and I'm trying to figure out how to condense about 12 hours of explanation into a couple of minutes. So let me start here. In most English translations, Christian translations, you'll see this translated as kiss the sun. That's number one. Number two, in most Jewish translations, you'll see it translated otherwise, maybe as worship in purity. And then you'll see some other translations, liberal Christian translations, that may say something like kiss his feet, you know, pay homage and kiss his feet. You think, where did his feet come from? So let me try to break down the problems, all right, in a way that everybody can understand. Number one, the Hebrew word kiss, when it's followed by an object, normally has a preposition. You kiss to someone or something, as opposed to just kissing directly, for the most part. So some would say there should be a preposition before sun. That's number one. Number two, where is the definite article? Why doesn't it say ha, the? Well, if you look through the whole psalm, you'll see the definite article basically is hardly there. And it's not uncommon in poetry to leave out the definite article, to leave out the word the in poetry. So that in itself doesn't mean anything. The big problem is, why do you have the Aramaic word for bar, sun? That's a rare word. It's found in Proverbs 31 in an otherwise largely Hebrew context where it means sun. But otherwise, you find it in the Aramaic portions of Daniel, which is Daniel 2:4 to 7:28. You find it there, the son of man, Barnasha, right? But why do you have Aramaic bar, whereas elsewhere in the psalm you have ben, sun, as expected? Why does it suddenly change languages? So one traditional answer is it's not bar, that's the wrong vowel, it's bor, which means purity. And nashku, bor, would mean kiss purity, meaning worship in purity, or something like that. Then, so that's where you get these different Jewish traditions trying to understand it. Then there was a famous German scholar who said the words got messed up, where it says, you know, rejoice with trembling, and so, no, that it's the whole thing got messed up, and instead take the one word here, switch it here, it was brilliant, move it around here, and you end up with, you know, kiss his feet. Ah, great. But again, it's a complete textual emendation. In other words, it's rearranging the words without any basis or foundation in the text. You say, well, what about the ancient versions? How is it understood in, say, the Targum, the Aramaic paraphrase or translation? How is it understood in the Septuagint, the Greek translation? How is it understood in the Latin? There are different renderings. In other words, they found it difficult to render and understand as well. So years ago, I wrote a very detailed scholarly paper on this and never got it published. Sent it to one journal. It didn't get published there, and I just never updated it. But, I mean, it's very, very technical and linguistic. I go through all the various positions. And my conclusion was this, that the reason bar is used there, it does mean son, and that the reason it's used there is because God is speaking to the nations. If you go to Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 11, James, when we're done with this talk, you'll take it out and you'll see that it's written in Aramaic, that this is what God is saying to the nations. And the verse is in Aramaic. So God, in the middle of an address through the prophet Jeremiah, now speaks to the nations and speaks to the nations in Aramaic. So I believe God is speaking to the kings of the earth in Aramaic. And it's possible that instead of Nashku, which is Hebrew, it could be an Aramaic imperative, which would be something like Nashiku. So kiss in Aramaic, kiss the son, and God says it in Aramaic to get their attention as this message is going to the nations. Now, here's the problem by saying, well, it just means worship in purity or something else or worship God, that the whole psalm is about the Lord and his anointed one, the Lord and his anointed. And if it's true that there's no reference to the son there, then a big force of the whole psalm is just missing. There should be a reference to the Lord and his anointed at the end of the psalm. I suggested that perhaps there was original Aramaic form berei, which would have had a final hey, which could have easily dropped out because it looks like the resh, meaning kiss his son, that could have been there. But I take it ultimately as a legitimate messianic prophecy, originally spoken about the earthly king David when he was installed and then subsequent kings, but finding its fulfillment in the Messiah. And that's why I think it's legitimate to translate with kiss the son. That is, and I did find grammatical parallels for it as well. All right, there may be follow-up questions. I want to get to some other calls, and I don't want to lose everybody listening and watching, but I hope that the great question by James enabled me to give you an answer that at least most of you could follow without thinking, what's this guy talking about? All right, thank you so much. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Hey, Nicole, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hey.
Well, I had a couple questions for you today.
All right.
I wanted to know, as you were growing up in a Jewish family, what was, I guess, the teaching of the coming Messiah? Were you taught that, and were you taught that he would be a human being or God in human form?
Okay, number one, we didn't talk that much about spiritual things because we weren't that religious growing up. But, yeah, I knew that we believed that the Messiah would come. I mean, very superficial. Christians believe the Messiah has come. Jews believe the Messiah will come. And our understanding was that one day he'll come and he'll establish peace on the earth. And that was pretty superficial. I did have some Hebrew school and some learning. But, yeah, that was the extent of it, that we do expect him to come and establish God's kingdom on the earth. And there'll be no more war and there'll be peace and things like that. Did we expect him to be a human? Sure, there was no Jewish expectation. No traditional Jew, no secular Jew is expecting the Messiah to be God in the flesh. That's something that we have to open up and explain to Jewish people what we believe. But no, and a traditional Jew is praying fervently every day, longing for the coming of the Messiah, looking for the coming of the Messiah, but expecting the Messiah to be fully human, just greatly used by God.
Okay, now then that will help me ask this question. So when the apostles... Peter, John, were around Jesus. I know it says in the Bible that they said he was the Messiah, but did they know at that time, like when they're looking in his eyes, wow, this is God manifested in the flesh, or was that later on?
Yeah, there's certainly a growing understanding. For example, Peter says in Matthew 16, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. They knew that he was the Son of God. They knew that in a unique way God was visiting them. But did they fully understand what that meant? In my view, no, I believe after the resurrection and ascension, things got much clearer. But even then, this is something that God had to unfold. I'll explain more in a moment.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. The disciples, the Jewish followers of Jesus, when did they understand his deity? When did they understand God's triunity? At what point did these things become real to them? These are great questions and questions thoroughly appropriate for our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. I want to address that question, these questions, in a moment. Want to take any Jewish-related calls you have, 866-34-TRUTH. And I want to give you a little backdrop on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to try to help you see how each side could see things very, very differently. Again, all Jewish-related, Hebrew-related, Israel-related calls, 866-34-TRUTH. Before I get into any of these questions or subjects, we've got a bunch of new videos and new articles up on our digital library. So new video questions we have. Should followers of Jesus cast out demons? We've got a new video. It is the progressive churches which are dying. Another video. Multitudes of Iranian Muslims are coming to faith in Jesus. What no one's telling you about Iran. New articles. 11 striking stories from 2017. Great call if you missed it. Dr. Brown speaks with a transgender evangelical. Is the UN fulfilling prophecy? Is Jerusalem the capital of Palestine? A lot of great videos and articles. So check them all out. They're there for free at AskDrBrown.org. Also, I just got a big stack of letters to sign of year-end gifts, thanking folks for their year-end contributions to the ministry. And I don't personally sign every letter for every gift that comes in, but just over a certain amount, and it's not all that much, I personally sign them and put a scripture down. So the end of the year, we put out some appeals and got a great response. So thank you. I just got the stack to sign, and I started to smile and looked through it and thought, wow, people are generous. So thank you, thank you, thank you. With your help, we can make all of this free to touch so many people, and we can reach Jewish people with the good news of Jesus, the Messiah. All right. For those of you that heard me say I was going to be on 700 Club tomorrow morning because of a storm on the East Coast, that's been rescheduled probably from March, so that won't be happening for those looking for that. All right. So the disciples, they heard Jesus say things like, before Abraham was, I am. They heard him say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Did they fully understand it? They could have a concept of him being Son of God, someone uniquely carrying divine nature, who came down from heaven without thinking that he was God himself. Exactly what they would have understood, their various questions in that regard. Was he a messenger? And as the messenger was carrying the authority of God, representing God, he said other things that gave his Jewish opponents the idea that he was making himself equal with God. Was that a right interpretation? What were the disciples thinking as this was happening, as he was getting persecuted? When he said, I and the Father are one. Now remember, he told them, I'm going to die and rise from the dead. They couldn't figure out what they meant. I will be killed and I will rise from the dead. What does he mean? So if they didn't get that, it's easy to think they didn't understand a lot of other things he was saying that may have been more esoteric. But we certainly know that after his resurrection, when Thomas sees him, he says, my Lord and my God. He recognized that. And we know that before Yeshua ascended to heaven, when he gave the Great Commission, he called his disciples to immerse new disciples in the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit. So he's putting himself right up in the midst of deity with Father and Spirit. And certainly, we see, for example, the martyrdom of Stephen in Acts the 7th chapter, that he prays to Jesus. So we see these things very early on. So at what point they fully understood aspects of God's triunity and how this was revealed to them and what stages, only God knows that. But if they didn't fully get things when he was there on earth, when he ascended to heaven, and they put together what he was saying and sent to spirit, obviously at these points these things became clear to them. And there were enough, you could say, Jewish parallels, either about angels and their role or other exalted heavenly figures, that there may have been a bridge from that for them to then understand God's complex unity. And then when you start going back through the Hebrew Bible, you realize, okay, God's seen and he's unseen. God appears in these different ways, and yet he's transcendent. So in those ways, God prepared the way for them to see or understand. But a traditional Jew would insist with all their being, no, the Messiah will be fully human. The Messiah will not be God. The Messiah will be fully human. That would be a very strong argument. If you want more details on this, go to volume 2 of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, volume 2. Or in shorter form, get the book, The Real Kosher Jesus. 866-34-TRUTH. Okay. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Let's just review a few things as, once again, these issues are freshly in the news before us with the UN voting against America's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, with President Trump threatening to withdraw funding for the Palestinian Authority if they don't engage in serious peace talks, for the Palestinian Authority saying, you're not going to buy us. This is a bribe and ransoming, and what are you doing? And then for a unity government between the Palestinians and Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And Hamas is considered a terrorist group by America and by some other nations. So how are you going to have a unity government with a recognized terrorist entity? How is America going to deal with that? So Palestinians say, you're trying to blackmail us with money. And America said, well, what are we giving you money for if you're bankrolling terrorists with it? You're bankrolling families of terrorists. And you're indoctrinating people against Israel. What are we giving you money for? So anyway. Like everything, there are two sides to every story. So the side that I am more comfortable with, and as I've studied history and sought to understand this, basically goes like this. That with the Jewish people scattered around the world after the destruction of the temple and then Jerusalem in the first centuries of this era, that there was always a Jewish presence in the land, albeit small. And this was considered the homeland. Israel was the homeland. Being in exile was divine judgment because of sin. This was universally understood in the Jewish world, that we're in exile because of our sin. If you believed in God, believed the Bible, that's what you believe. We're in exile because of our sin, and we're praying to be restored back to the land. And being restored back to the land will be part of the favor of God and will be part of his blessing and love for his people. And Jerusalem is our eternal capital, and the city towards which we pray. So that would be the Jewish hope. Now, there were various other peoples that continued to live in the land of Israel. But after the destruction of the temple in 135 of this era, the Roman Emperor Hadrian renamed the country, renamed the territories there. It was no longer Judea or Samaria. No, it was now Palestine. Why? Because he was taking the ancient name Philistine, the enemies of Israel. By the way, the Philistines were basically extinct as a people at that point, had been conquered and absorbed by others. And he then changed the name of the territories there to Palestine. Why? And in Arabic, it sounds very much like Philistine. Why did he do it? He did it in mockery. He did it in derision. He did it to further say, okay, your old sacred homeland, we're going to name it after your enemies. That's what he did. But then that's how it became named and known over the centuries, Palestine. All right, so to whom was Palestine homeland? Well, there are various people who lived there. There were not people who considered, okay, we are Palestinians. There was no such ancient identity of a people at that point. And in fact, throughout much of the Middle East, you didn't have the borders that we have now. There were tribal affiliations and things like that. And that's how a lot of the region was structured. So with the rise of Islam, it's not long after the life and death of Muhammad that you have a lot of consolidating of territories, Islamic territories. And now Jerusalem is under Islamic control. Palestine is under Islamic control. It now becomes an important city in the Muslim world. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is built there. The Dome of the Rock is built there. It's from Jerusalem that Muhammad allegedly has his ascent to heaven. On the other hand, it's never mentioned in the Quran by name. And the early names of it referred to, the holy place, the holy city, with apparent reference back to the fact that that's where the holy temple used to be. So in any case, over those centuries, the cities of Mecca and Medina were far more important in Islam than Jerusalem. And if you lived in Jerusalem, you prayed facing Mecca, that would mean your backs to Jerusalem, you prayed facing Mecca. And there was no long-term Arabic prayer, Quranic prayer, oh, bring us back to Jerusalem and bring us back to Palestine, because that was not considered the Holy Land, but it was conquered. And then other groups conquered it. Christian groups conquered it. And it went back and forth, and different ones had control. And people from many different nations lived there, including Jews. I think what I'm telling you so far, most would accept, is just very, very generic and basic. And yes, we agree. Okay, so we go on from there. And we're going to fast forward. In the 1800s, when Mark Twain visited the Holy Land, as Christians would have called it, Palestine as it would have been more widely known, he just talked about how uncultivated the land was. Swamps and not a lot of population there. This is really true, that it was not this place where everyone said, this is our homeland, this is our place, this is our heritage. Now, there were some Arabs who had lived there for centuries. And there is even speculation that some of them were originally Jews and that they converted under pressure from Islam and then continued to live there. Some DNA tests suggest that a good number of Palestinians may be Jews, and some of them even have some secret Jewish practices and customs they still hold to. It's fascinating. That's another subject. But for the most part, if you take the population of the land in the late 1800s, land of Israel, and compare it to now, it was a small fraction. So now what happens is that more Jews begin to move back to the land late 1800s. In some countries, it was more difficult for them to live. They began to move back. You said, why didn't they move back earlier? Some say there was just a Jewish passivity to do it because the belief was the Messiah is going to regather us. So we pray, and then the Messiah regathers us. And then others said it was simply economic difficulties, or just to resettle, to get large numbers of Jews to do it wasn't going to happen. But towards the end of the 1800s, more Jews begin to come cultivate the land. That brings in more Arab population out to work the land. And then from there, we'll continue. Stay with us.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So let me continue with my very brief overview of the modern Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, have the rise of the Zionist movement, which was largely secular. For example, Theodor Herzl was a secular Jew, one of the men behind the modern Zionist movement. And he considered other places other than Israel, Palestine, for the return of the Jews. Perhaps Uganda could be a place where all Jews would go. But there was a recognition with the rising tide of anti-Semitism worldwide that the Jews really needed their own homeland. And I see the hand of God in all of this. So Jewish people began to come back to the land, began to buy land from landowners there, began to settle it, develop it. More and more Arabs began to move in from neighboring areas, countries, because of the economic growth and prosperity. And you pretty much have a peaceful coexistence, a majority Arab population, but growing, and a growing minority Jewish population. In the 1920s, conflicts began, and From what I can tell, as honestly as I can read it and understand it, there was some hostility stirred up towards the Jewish people by some radical Muslims. These were the earliest intifadas in the 1920s and 1930s, where suddenly there were attacks on Jewish people and mass murder of some Jewish populations, you know, dozens of people killed in certain areas and things like that, an attack in Hebron, for example. And a key man involved in all this was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem's ultimate position, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who drew on ancient Islamic anti-Semitism to stir up hostility towards the Jewish people. He ended up being a confidant of Adolf Hitler, and some believe that he's the one who gave the gas chamber suggestion to Adolf Hitler for exterminating Jews. Some believe that. I'm talking about historians. Some historians believe that. In any case, what happens is this, that you now have a growing tension between these peoples living side by side, but still the potential for peaceful coexistence. A proposal is then made, because the Balfour Declaration 1917 and Palestine under British control after World War II, and now kind of restructuring of some boundaries and nation-making in this tribal world of the Muslim Arab Middle East, that there's a desire now to say, okay, let's have a state for the Jewish people and let's have a state for the Arab people side by side. And that was offered to the Jewish people. We're talking 1930s now. And even though it was hardly favorable and it was not something that was ideal, it was accepted by the Jewish leadership, but the Arab leadership rejected it. And as I've talked to Palestinians today, their position is, well, why would we have accepted it? That we lived there for generations. Why accept this division and give some of our land away to others? But really, it was fair and it was equitable. And since Palestinians have said we'd like our own state, if they'd done it back then, they would have been in better shape than today. So now you have growing hostility as the population numbers are growing. And then there's more animus against the Jewish people. Now you get into the period of World War II, and Jews are trying to flee from Nazi Europe to save their lives, to save their families, to save their children, trying to flee to Palestine. And by the way, the ones who called themselves Palestinians and took on a Palestinian identity were the Jews. So what we call today the Jerusalem Post was the Palestine Post. And if you went to hear the Palestinian orchestra play, it was a Jewish orchestra. The people there were not called Palestinians. They did not identify as Palestinians. That would imply some type of national heritage or background. They did not identify as such. Even those who had lived there for generations, it was not part of the consciousness. There was never a Palestinian state, so to say. Now, with Jews being threatened with extermination around the world, now with the British not allowing Jews to flee Nazi Europe and to make their way into Israel, there were Jewish resistance movements that grew up and that fought violently against the British. There were assassinations of British leaders. There was the famous bombing of the King David Hotel, which resulted in casualties, and the Jews involved said, we sent out pamphlets. We said there's a bomb going, it's going to go, get out of the building. We don't want to kill anybody. People didn't take it seriously. The bomb went off, some were killed. These things happen, but they'd be very much parallel to our American war against Britain, that there were casualties of war. Menachem Begin was considered a terrorist by the Arab world. We looked at him as a freedom fighter. In any case, what ultimately happens is the UN in 1947 says, okay, two states, the Jews accept, the Arab world does not, the Arab leadership, I fault the Arab leadership. And what ends up happening, and that's why Ephraim Karsh wrote a book called Palestine Betrayed. What ends up happening now is that the Arab nations, surrounding Arab nations, declare war on Israel. Israel fights for its life and survives, I believe, with God's help. And then after there's this massive armament buildup and there's going to be a massive attack on Israel in 1967, Israel preemptively takes out the Egyptian Air Force. And in the Six-Day War in 1967, now extends its territory, reunites Jerusalem, which had been lost in the 1948 war, reunites Jerusalem, and takes what we call Judea and Samaria, but which others call the West Bank, and now called the occupied territories. And Israel said, look, this is what we got in war. This is our ancient homeland. And This is reality on the ground. Accept it. Ultimately, Israel pulls out of Gaza, what was it, 2005. It has gone downhill. It has been bad for the people of Gaza, been bad for Israel. But Israel did that under American pressure. And right now, there's ongoing conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And they're saying, look, this is our old homeland. We're back here. We want to live side by side with you. Don't fight us. Don't try to kill us. Palestinian perspective is that we were here before you were here. You're occupiers. You're living in our territory. And you're mistreating us. And we don't. Why do we have to make a peace deal with you? You're the occupiers. You're breaking UN resolutions. And just give us our land back. And okay, you can have this slice here, but we want the rest of it back. And then we'll have peace. You're the occupiers. Now, I know I made short shrift of the latter argument, but looking at the clock and time is short. But here's the point. Palestinians would say, look, we're mistreated every single day. Palestinians would say, we're not getting a fair deal every single day. And Israel would say, if you don't want to kill us, and you work against terrorism, and we can really work side by side, you'll prosper. You won't need the checkpoints, you won't need the security barriers and the walls or any of this. We can live side by side. And the arguments go back and forth and on and on. And Israel says, look, we fought a war for liberation. We fought a war for freedom. You tried to wipe us out. We fought back. Palestinians said, look, you engaged in a campaign to annihilate our villages and our heritage and destroy us, and you're evil people and you're brutal, and it's a disaster. Al-Nakba in Arabic, the disaster. So that's how it's viewed from that perspective. But here's an important point I want to make. One leader once said this. Up until the Six-Day War, I was a Jordanian. The day after, I was a Palestinian. In other words, this whole idea of a Palestinian people is actually a myth, even though there have been people who've lived there for centuries. Hey, to get more on this, go to my website, AskDrBrown.org, and click on the video, Was Israel an Evil Occupier, or Is Israel an Evil Occupier? It's a lecture I gave at University of South Florida a few years ago when we couldn't find anyone to debate me on it. But check out the video, Is Israel an Evil Occupier? It's on the website. You can also order it. It's a great resource, DVD with Q&A as well. 866-34-TRUTH. With that, let me try to grab one call in Dallas, Texas. George, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Real quickly, Genesis, I'm talking about different translations. Some say heaven, some say heaven. Also, the name of God, some translations say Adonai, others say Yahweh. Which is correct?
Okay, so first thing, the word for sky, heaven, heavens in Hebrew is shamayim, which is a dual form. Now, dual doesn't always mean two distinct things, like the word mayim in Hebrew. That's water, right, is a dual form. But my knees, that's birkayim, knees, and ears, oznayim, ears, and eyes, enayim, eyes, and then hands, yadayim, hands, right, feet, raglayim. So shamayim, dual form. It could be translated heavens or heaven. It doesn't mean heaven in the sense of the place, the celestial city where God dwells. It means heaven in terms of sky. So either the heavens meaning all, the sky, the universe, right? And then Shemayim Va'aretz, heavens and earth, that means the whole universe. You can translate it heaven and earth or heavens and earth. To translate it sky, there it means more than that, okay? Sometimes it can just mean sky, but normally it means either heavens or heaven, but not specifically the celestial dwelling place heaven in a creation context like that. As for Lord, when you see the Hebrew Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Y-H-W-H, when you see those consonants, as a traditional Jew, you don't pronounce them. Instead, you say Adonai, which means Lord. Or you say Hashem, which means the name, literally, but just another way of saying the name. Christians, in some translations, read it as Jehovah, which was a misnomer. The more likely pronunciation is Yahweh. To find out more on those details, sir, go to my website, AskDrBrown.org, and just search for the word Jehovah. AskDrBrown.org, search for the word Jehovah, and you'll get more on that. But Tree of Life Bible, for example, which is a Messianic Jewish translation, it says Adonai when that occurs, and that's a perfectly good way to render it. Hey, friends, check out the resources on our website. Stand with us as we reach out to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Back with you and your questions tomorrow.